You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 108. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'm your host. And today we are talking about building partnerships at the state and federal level in Colorado. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch, or Ute Peoples, treaty lands, the Dineta, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. And today, we have Stacy Coleman on the show. Stacy currently serves as the Assistant Director for Tribal Affairs with Colorado's Department of Natural Resources. Stacy completed her bachelor's at Colorado State University and then her JD through a joint program with Northeastern Law School and Vermont Law School, with a focus on environmental law and policy. Stacy previously worked, I think this is a first for this podcast, for the U.S. Department of Justice for 15 years, serving as a trial and senior attorney. She calls three places home: New Mexico, Wyoming, and Colorado, has a bicultural background, and most importantly, I agree, green chili is her superfood. As it should be. I'm assuming Hatch, right? We're not talking Pueblo here, right?
Absolutely, Hatch. Oh, mate. That might be starting out on a controversial piece here.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sorry. Maybe we shouldn't go there. All of your state employee people are going to be like, what are you doing? Represent your state.
You know, New Mexico runs deep, so yeah.
I've never even lived in New Mexico. I've only lived in Arizona and Colorado, but like, since we're right there on the border, our part of Colorado a lot of ways feels more like New Mexico than Colorado. But
it does to me too. That's why I enjoy being in the southwest of Colorado so much.
It's great. Anyway, so obviously I'm super excited to have Stacy on the show. It's been a long con to get her on, but very excited both because you have such a legal background, which we don't get on the show very often, and also because I just like talking to you. So, well, and I guess third, also, I don't actually have people on very often that I like actually work with. I don't know why that happens quite like that, but I think because we're too busy doing the thing. But so yeah, so excited to actually get to talk to somebody that I work with. So
I'm excited too. I am a fan of the podcast. You know, I listen to it often. And also I'm just excited to share some of, you know, my experiences that I've had, and maybe they resonate with others. Also trying to work in these different spaces within interesting systems at the state and federal government level. So it's really exciting to be here today.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, so definitely since you have a bit of a different background than most of the guests, I really especially want to hear about how you got to the work that you're doing today. So what, first of all, got you interested in the law? What kind of work were you interested in at first? You know, what was your journey?
You're going to love this one. And I'm not sure that we've talked about this before, Okay. Just in our work intersection and other things. But I mean, first, I would say that like anyone, you don't get to where you're at without a lot of help from family, friends, and mm-hmm. life mentors and community. So in the broadest way possible, all of those communities, people have supported me to get here because I am, you know, both Chicana and Indigenous. And that's not something, you know, especially for the time frame that we were growing up in our generation, that was not common to be, you know, sort of going into the field of law. There isn't a large percentage of Indigenous lawyers in this country. So it takes a lot to sort of go into these different areas. And it's really standing on the shoulders of community from before. But all of those people in my life have shaped my values and experiences in the most profound ways. That's why I call three states home too. My family roots are in Northern New Mexico. That's where my ancestral lineage is from. And we moved up to my family before me moved up to Wyoming to find jobs on the railroad and eventually moved to Colorado in the 90s because, you know, Colorado's rad. But, you know, most importantly, like I mentioned, I'm connected very deeply to all these places in important ways. So they influenced a lot of where I went in my life because I have a strong connection to nature because of that and community. And that influenced my decisions. But I'm a first generation graduate student, so shout out to all those that are really working hard too and are also first generation college students, graduates. But I went to Colorado State University actually because, drum roll, I went there to go into veterinary medicine. So, you know, how you go from veterinary medicine to a lawyer is quite a turn, but I wanted to specifically specialize in large animals. That was one of my childhood dreams. And the funny thing is these things, the strangest things happen in life. And I think they turn you where maybe you're supposed to go. But I developed allergies to horses when I was in college as an adult. Wow. So I ended up taking a turn and being like, what do? And it was already one of those question marks that you have as a first generation student. You don't necessarily have some of those areas of guidance built in that others may have. And I'm not really sure that I actually received a lot of guidance from the school either, what to do instead, because I was really in their sort of pre-vet program type of thing. And so I just went ahead and leaned into poli-sci and found it really interesting because it brought together a lot of environmental issues that I was interested in personally and looking at this from different lenses. And CSU at the time did not have a robust sort of, I would say, area of studies that could really bring out, you know, indigenous perspectives. I think it's certainly going that way now. Fort Lewis was probably the leader and continues to be in that. But that being said, I had great mentors there. And because of that, I went ahead and chose to go the poli-sci route and ended up in Washington, D.C. after Fort Collins. And I ended up there just because I had one cousin that lived out there. So again, the universe just takes you where you need to go. So there wasn't a real good reason for going out to D.C. other than maybe what's west goes east goes west type of thing. And I was lucky enough to get a job right away. It was when I graduated from CSU, it was around 2002. So the jobs were a little slim picking at the time, and I was glad to be able to get a job out there. And it was as a paralegal at a large law firm. And I'd never worked at a law firm, had never fully thought about that. I did do some work with Colorado Legal Services when I was at CSU on migrant farm worker and pesticide matters, and had also taken a few undergrad classes focused on law, but that was it. So entering this space in a large law firm was eye-opening and scary. I had never been in a large law firm, and it definitely saw the world. So I was placed into their regulatory section that focused on energy issues. And that made me really decide, I want to go work in environmental law, and I'd like to work for the public sector. So from there, I went to law school up in Boston and was able to have a wonderful experience up there. I'd received good advice from a life mentor saying, hey, for your law school experience, focus on finding a school that will give you a lot of hands-on experience. Northeastern Law School is known for its co-op program. At the time, it was one of only, I think, two law schools that provided a co-op experience.
What does that mean exactly?
What that means is that built into the educational programming is the opportunity to go out and do full-time internships. So for the law school, we had a traditional first year of semesters that people may be accustomed to. And then after that, it turned into a quarter program. So I would be in school for a quarter, then off on a full-time internship for a quarter than in school. And that was the way that the last 2 years of the JD program was formatted. And it was wonderful because it allowed me to do a joint program with Vermont Law School, going up there to get more environmental law focused classes and indigenous law focused environmental law focused classes that Northeastern didn't have at the time, and still complete my JD within a similar time frame that was expected. And it also allowed me to have 4 full-time internships, which gave me additional experience in other ways that other law students going to maybe traditionally formatted schools didn't get. And I think also helped me ultimately get into the Attorney General Honors Program with the U.S. Department of Justice after I graduated from law school. That's the only way at the time to get in directly as a newly minted, you know, JD graduate and lawyer. Otherwise, folks typically have to go through a process of applying for a lateral position. So it's pretty great to be a newbie lawyer and be working at the U.S. Department of Justice. I got into their environmental enforcement section, which is where I wanted to work. It's where I also did an internship during my law school experience. And from there, I spent almost 15 years there working as a trial and senior attorney. And it was an incredible experience. It continues to be one of my top professional experiences. Although I might just be lucky because working for the state is awfully interesting and amazing too. But that time at DOJ as a trial attorney and helping out too with their law clerk program so that we could integrate and work on having more avenues and pathways for Indigenous students to the Environmental Enforcement Section in U.S. Department of Justice, to also supporting different hiring pieces within our section and efforts to go into that so that there could be different lenses. All these things are important. And I think ultimately, when I think about all of these places that I've worked, it really helps to have different types of representation within just really the scope of the organization and where they're working. So not only at an entry level, but at a leadership level too. And maybe I'll just leave it there because, you know, it was an interesting pathway to get where I am at this point. And I'm not, there actually aren't a lot of lawyers working on the policy side here in the Department of Natural Resources, but there are a few of us. And I think that what we bring to it is really an interesting lens, both on the legal side of policy development, which usually happens on the back end, but we can bring it a little bit more to the front end when we're thinking about this. And certainly in the area of federal Indian law and policy, that is complex. It's nuanced. It's an area that takes great care to work within. And while in my position at Department of Natural Resources, I'm not working as a lawyer, it still brings a lot of different sort of helpful experiences and perspectives to this work. And maybe that's another piece where I need to mention here that all of my experiences and thoughts that I share today are really my own personal experiences and just a reminder to folks that they're not the department's opinions or perspectives. They're mine alone, and I'm here to share them in that personal capacity.
Okay. So I know obviously we want to focus most of this time on your work here in Colorado, your current work, things like that. But just so the audience can get like a little bit of a flavor of what that looked like when you were at DOJ, is there maybe an example project or something like that kind of demonstrates like what it looked like, what you were doing when you were there?
Yes. I think maybe the way to describe it is the work of the Environmental Enforcement Section is really to enforce federal environmental laws. So the way we were set up was really by regions and as they related to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. And I was assigned to regions 3 and 8. So that's some of the area out in the East Coast, as well as here in the Mountain West, including Colorado for Region 8. And the reason why we're assigned to those EPA regions is EPA is our client. They're our main client. It's not that there aren't others, but our main client. And we are their attorneys as they go into federal courts. EPA also has its own attorneys that it works with too at the agency level, but we are their official attorneys when they're going into federal court matters. And when you think about sort of what does that mean to enforce federal environmental laws, think about some of these areas where you've had major environmental catastrophes across the United States. That's usually the environmental enforcement section playing a role in some capacity in the background in bringing different types of cases to hold the parties that are, you know, accountable or liable, accountable. So that is what we do. Think of Superfund sites. Think of water quality issues. Think of air quality issues. All sorts of federal environmental statutes that we enforce at the environmental enforcement section. It was truly an amazing job for a lot of reasons, not only because of the types of cases we were bringing as trial attorneys and senior attorneys that really have the ability to impact and influence, you know, environmental law across the United States and communities that are impacted by these issues, but it was just a tremendous group of attorneys too that I worked with in the environmental enforcement section. And because of that, I had a great opportunity to learn a lot from them too.
And did you ever get to use, while you were there, the federal Indian law portion?
Yes, I not only intersected with work with tribal nations through my direct casework that I had. That might be a matter where we would be bringing a case against an entity that may have violated federal environmental laws within tribal lands, Indian country, or it may be because we have a case where there are potential violations, you know, outside of, and I say Indian country because that's a legal term, Indian country, but impact that area too. So it was not only through my direct cases that I worked on, it was also through my position as a tribal coordinator within the environmental enforcement section and actively working with other colleagues within my section as they are working and developing on these cases across the country too that have impacts to Indian country and tribes and greater community.
Okay, well, I'm sure we could spend a long time talking about that, but we are already at our first break point. So we're going to take a break and then we're going to move on and talk about your work here in Colorado. So we will be right back here after a second. Okay, so diving right back in, you're at this job, you're really enjoying it, getting a lot from it. So what led to you switching to the job with the state of Colorado?
Ah, yes, it's a good question. And I think it's a little bit of that universe magic that I was talking mm-hmm. about at the mm-hmm. beginning some, because I was nearing these 15 years at DOJ and within the enforcement section. And I was really wanting to shift my docket work to more of majority of my time working on tribal cases or cases that have tribal impacts is probably the better way to phrase it. And I was doing a lot of this work in different capacities, but it was outside of my casework on some of these pieces, we're really thinking about how do you build up representation in a way that's authentic and meaningful within, you know, workforce and office space. It was all happening in my, quote, free time, which any litigator out there will know you don't actually have a lot of free time. So it just reached that inflection point, and it was really hard to leave because wonderful place to work for those 15 years, tremendous legal minds, just exceptional work ethic of all those that I encountered within, you know, the federal government and just being a public servant. And this job just showed up. I hadn't applied for a job in 15 years.
Yeah, wow.
I'm not even sure I remembered how to, but I saw this and I thought, well, this seems like, why not? Why not? This seems like a good opportunity to work full time on issues that impact Indigenous communities, communities that, you know, I'm part of and in different ways. And so I applied and didn't really know if I would even get an interview or anything like that, because again, I've been doing this other job for 15 years. And I think a lot of times as minorities, sometimes that word, gosh, but that we self-select ourselves out of opportunities.
Both and women too. So
yes,
you got the double whammy.
Double whammy, you know? And so I was like, don't select yourself out.
Mm-hmm.
Just go ahead and go for it. See what happens. And it ended up working out really well in terms of, you know, I'm having the opportunity to work with the state to really get a different perspective on some of this specific work that the Department of Natural Resources is trying to do with tribal nations and greater community, and bring along that experience that I have from the federal level, but also evaluate it in a much different lens and way. And have less of an, at the federal level, it was kind of like an more than one arm's length removal from direct community. And you felt that these are impactful cases that do have positive impacts on community, but you are far away from that work a bit. And I missed being closer to community too. And this brings me closer into that work, and some of the professional aspects I have on the personal side, it's just deeply meaningful. And, you know, to work with in mixed Indigenous communities, you know, folks that are enrolled, tribal governments, all of these areas that, and communities that I've worked with in the past at different levels, but are also part of, you know, my history in growing up too. So this was, that's why the change probably, and I took a chance. And for those that are ever wondering if you should, if you've been in a great job for 15 years, I would emphatically say yes, it's really important. And I'm glad I did. And this is the first time that the Department of Natural Resources has had a role like this ever. And they specifically put it into more of a leadership position within the executive department for a reason. They had, you know, really listened to a lot of the work that had come out of an environmental justice report and work group on, or task force on this type of EJ related work, I guess, is how they were framing it, to build out tribal liaison positions within all of the state agencies. And not all of our state agencies have that yet, but the Department of Natural Resources has this particular position and role. And I think it has. We've seen a lot of things move forward and to the front of DNR's docket of work because of, you know, this position and really creating more of a direct line that tribal governments can have to DNR leadership that has decision-making power, and for community too. It has not been a smooth ride, but it is happening. And I think that's really important because we are underrepresented in these systems. And as I see leadership and staff learning about different ways of thinking, why it's important, widening their perspective, it's really hopefully leading to maybe systemic changes within a government system built on colonization and other harmful policies to policies that can be healing to many different communities and that people ecosystem that we talk about too.
So And again, I know obviously your caveat earlier that you are here, you know, providing your own personal opinions, not representing the Department of Natural Resources in this moment. But could you describe what your current job is, basically? Like, what are you tasked with doing? What does it look like?
Yeah, the dailies and what it says on paper, too. Well, my position, I would say, is evolving, and it will be evolving. But really what I do is work within the Department of Natural Resources, within their executive office. And that means that I am able to collaborate, partner, work with all of our divisions that fall under the Department of Natural Resources umbrella there. That includes, you know, Colorado Parks and Wildlife. That includes Colorado Water Conservation Board, ECMC. Gosh, I could go through all of them, but I'm not sure that's really what folks want to hear. But it really is. It's something to think about, though, because as you think about putting these positions in place, you need to think about how much one person will get be pulled in a lot of different directions to help divisions with significant and important missions that they are advancing. That said, I work with all of our divisions there on any matters that directly or indirectly impact tribal nations, so tribal governments, and the greater American Indian Indigenous community across Colorado. And it requires me to work closely with the Colorado Commission of Indian Affairs, especially since they are the official state liaison. I work closely with not only the two tribal nations, the Southern Ute Indian Tribe and the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe, that have, I guess, for lack of a better term, official residency through reservation land status here in Colorado, and also other tribal nations that have been forcibly removed through historical federal policies from Colorado, but have ancestral ties and continuing ties to Colorado. And I also work with greater community there too. And so it's a role that is sort of requiring, I would say, a lot right now. And hopefully one of the hopes is to build this out into a program and have that really be something that's within the long-term value system and organizational structure of the Department of Natural Resources. So I'm in a day, I could be starting out in, you know, a few programmatic meetings with different divisions on different areas that they're trying to advance on an issue with a tribal government or more than one tribal government, to then moving to, you know, actually going to a state park to be able to sit down and talk with staff there about some of the ideas that they're hoping to advance as well in this area through consultation and community engagement and walking through the park so that we can at least start thinking about that, those opportunities that are there to going to and supporting, you know, different types of repatriation matters in the afternoon. So it's a little bit all over. I travel a lot for my job too, because it's really important to be where everybody else is at. You don't want to just be in Denver. That's not meeting with community. That's not meeting with tribal nations. And it's an important part of my job to be able to meet with people in order to talk about and really build that relationship over time. We need to be able to build that relationship and have that at the core of the center and ensure that we're building opportunities for people, for tribal nations and greater community to lead. So that's what I'm trying to do. That's my personal, I guess, you know, value that I try to bring here, is that relationship piece and relationship building. But I do a lot. I mean, we're doing legislative session, policy work. It's sort of everything that could fall under a policy umbrella.
I mean, that's a lot. I mean, right? Even just if CPW had their own tribal affairs program, that would already be massive, let alone all of the different divisions. So can you maybe give like an example of some specific initiatives or things that you've been working on?
Absolutely. So one of the strategic priorities that we developed when I came into this position was to enhance tribal and community engagement. what that really means is it's a long arc. And there are going to be areas that we really focusing on to develop that relationship piece. Some of those initiatives in the past year that maybe folks are familiar with that are in Colorado and kind of steeped in this work and others may not be, are really the development of the Colorado's outdoor strategy and our guidance framework on tribal collaboration in conservation, outdoor recreation, and climate resilience. And this is a, I think it's a great example of how collaborative partnerships at the federal, state, local, regional level can really come together to evaluate how we're working as partners on these landscape issues across Colorado in those areas of conservation, outdoor recreation, and climate resiliency, but also evaluate and take a strong look about our tribal and community partnerships that we're developing. And that's really what that guidance framework for tribal collaboration is starting to step towards. It took many years to develop this. And what I like most about the guidance framework is that it's really bringing together the cultural and spiritual, and my hope in some ways supporting the priorities of community and tribes, but also traditional lifeways. And that's a piece that can often get really just left out of conservation conversations that have such a Western viewpoint and the North American model and other pieces. And it's more of an adaptive management model. And it's really focused on that relationship building again. So one of the things when you look at this guidance framework, it's meant to be built out in volumes. And it really anchors, I think, some of the values that I've seen, you know, personally, and also that I see with other types of government institutions and nonprofits and other entities talk about, of building out that relationship over time and bringing a two-eyed lens into this work on conservation and realizing how important it is to center the longest stewards and caretakers of this land in the middle of that planning and framework. So it's a neat thing to look into for those that haven't seen it yet. I mean, I think we'll link it here to this particular podcast episode, but I know that other states are doing a lot of really interesting things too. And I would encourage us all to work together to the benefit of tribes and community in this multi-state work vision. And one of the other things that builds on top of this guidance framework is really the opportunity that Colorado Parks and Wildlife led this year to areas of doing community listening sessions that are statewide with the American Indian and Indigenous community focused on state parks and really setting a platform for community to help shape the priorities of CPW moving forward. That's Colorado Parks and Wildlife. And also the first ever tribal summit that was held at Colorado Parks and Wildlife's Partners in the Outdoors Conference too this year. So what I hope is that what folks are seeing are really this important, it's more than just a value setting, it's actually taking affirmative steps and actions and centering tribal voices throughout this work. And those are some of the initiatives that I've just seen in the last year that I've been lucky enough to have been a part of and, you know, to help work on and facilitate that I hope are really something that the tribal governments we work with, the community, you know, all the communities across the state are proud of and see that there is a relationship building that's happening that's not just for the now, that's into the future, and that's seven generations forward thinking.
Yeah. All right. We're already at that second break point. It comes so fast. So we will be right back here in a minute, and we will keep talking about the work that you're doing for the Department of Natural Resources. So see everybody here in a second. So for our final segment, we could go. But in thinking about your current work in Colorado, and also I suppose your work at the DOJ, law school, wherever you want to go with this, what would you like to see more of or less of or changed with this type of work, you know, and thinking back about all of those experiences?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think a lot of things come up that I would love to see evolve. And I don't want to sound too policy wonky, but one of these pieces is thinking about, and I know we think about it all the time in different ways, and especially as Indigenous people, but the systems that we're having to work within and the layering of those systems that are there in place, especially through government, federal government, state government, gosh, county, local, everything. So I think what I would like to see, or maybe continue to strive working towards, is how we can learn how to work in these systems to the benefit of our communities better. And I think that is an important part, to learn these systems, because they are complex and they're intended to be complex. And I think if it's hard to be a public servant in within these different systems too, in different ways, and it's also important to also to work within these systems of government too. And it's because it is reciprocal. You're helping others learn a different way of thinking within these government systems, and you're also helping bring the ability for public servants and to connect more with community and tribes directly. So these systems want to always move towards their status quo. So it's important that we continue to bring in Indigenous representation to all levels and to help support these institutions and really being thoughtful and mindful with the work that they do and how it impacts. I think that's to the greater benefit of the institutions too, to be able to serve its constituents well and in a diverse array of communities. I also want to see, I view my role personally as in this role with the Department of Natural Resources, setting up a foundation to try to help the next generation move into this. I have this view that oftentimes leadership can stay too long in a position. And what we really should be doing, if we're really thinking to support the next generation and seven generations ahead, is to do my best to build somewhat of a stable foundation and then move to allow the next generation to come in with their vibrant ideas and to really be able to advance this incredible work that also celebrates tribes and communities in a very beautiful way. And that's what I would like to see. There's so many incredible youth leaders that are out there right now. And to me, if I can do the part of the work that might be a little bit more sticky or require different perspectives that are helped through my background as a lawyer and also, you know, in this policy advisor role, and get that framework set up, I think that I'll be really, you know, at least satisfied with where we got. And I definitely don't want to, again, be that person that just stays in a role indefinitely, when I think institutions, especially public institutions, should really get the value of what it means to bring in the next generation of leadership sooner rather than later.
So what would that look like on the ground in your position?
On the ground, it's really being able to encourage youth leadership to come and learn about the work that we do here. It's being transparent about the type of work that happens within these government systems so that people aren't wondering and making it seem like this. It is complex. And if government is more transparent, I truly believe that it takes some of that complexity out and you can really build on that partnership piece that makes these institutions stronger too in the long run and work to the benefit for community at a larger level. And I also think that it means that, you know, we're creating internship programs too that allows for that new and next leadership to be able to start learning and working within these systems sooner rather than later. And hopefully we aren't talking about as much these different layered systems. I don't know if that's ever going to go away when you just have different levels of jurisdiction and how generally this system is built on three branches of government. But
I do think that there is a lot of different ways of governing that can happen, especially at a state level, that can be unique and supportive, and when combined and working with local and county governments, really be powerful in affecting good policy for all of the work that we do, but especially even if we're looking in that area of the, you know, Colorado's outdoor strategy, conservation, outdoor recreation, climate resilience, really lend a lot of benefit to that.
So wait, it's Colorado Outdoor Strategy, outdoor, what was it again?
It's Colorado Outdoor Strategy, and within that we have a guidance framework for tribal collaboration. It's a bit of a mouthful.
So I know this is a new thing. So has there really been an opportunity so far to try and implement it all, or are you guys pretty much still just like at the announcing phase?
We are in the first year of implementation. So what that has meant, maybe I should clarify, the first year of implementation for the Colorado Outdoor Strategy, which includes the guidance framework for tribal collaboration. And what that means is really we're trying to ensure that as many people are aware of this particular work and statewide initiative that brought together many different partners across the state, including tribal nations and indigenous community, to be able to ensure that we are doing training on this particular initiative, because there is a lot of resources that are provided in the resource hub that's associated with this, ways to use those resources when you're doing planning, regional planning that can connect at a sort of landscape statewide level on conservation, recreation, and climate resiliency. And that means we've done in-person trainings, virtual trainings, just really getting the word out. From that, we're still implementing it ourselves. And I would say what I see is that the Department of Natural Resources is still implementing this. And what that means is not only because Colorado Parks and Wildlife is the lead on this particular initiative, demonstrating that through different types of actions being advanced, such as the community listening sessions and Tribal Summit, but also ensuring that we're having those actions advanced across the Department of Natural Resources within all of our other divisions there too. So this is year one. It's a little bit of a framework building in terms of ensuring that everybody knows about it and knows how to use this particular strategy and the tools that it has. And then you're going to see this build out over the next 5 years, hopefully in ways that will also advance additional versions and volumes of the guidance framework for tribal collaboration.
Yeah. So what are you, like, over the next 5 years, what could that look like?
Gosh, I actually think personally that there could be, because again, the reminder here, my personal capacity, but I can see a lot of change happening within the work happening across the state in 5 years. When I see the partnerships that are happening and this entire initiative, Colorado Outdoor Strategy, Guidance Framework for Tribal Collaboration, the heart of it are those relationships and partnerships. Mm-hmm. And because of the way that really endeavoring, that I can see the state endeavoring, that I can see other partners endeavoring to work together to center tribal priorities, indigenous community priorities in this work, it could change dramatically even in 5 years with that type of partnership level happening across the state. And that it includes beyond just the state government working with the federal government or the state government working with local or county governments. It includes working a lot with our non-governmental organizations and partners there. Again, ensuring that community leaders are included in this. It really has the potential to be transformational over time here, even on that short timeline of 5 years, if folks lean into that partnership piece. And that sometimes can be a hard thing for many reasons. Mm-hmm. But hopefully when we're partnering around areas that impact us, all of our communities statewide and beyond, that when we're facing these really tremendous environmental impacts that we're seeing across the state through water, you know, forestry health, wildfire mitigation, all of these areas, that partnership can be based on how we come together as communities to impact on a landscape view issues that are affecting us all. across jurisdictional borders, across where we live geographically and beyond.
Yeah. So obviously you guys are doing a lot in Colorado to try and set things up for the next generation, you know, policy-wise, all of these things. Are there other states, or it doesn't even have to be state governments, but like local, federal, whatever, that you feel like are doing things that, you know, would like to see, or you're like, wow, that's really awesome outside of Colorado or inside of Colorado for local governments? Don't want to forget them.
Yes. Yes. I would say that we are looking everywhere. At least I am. I'm looking everywhere in terms of other great work that other entities are doing that maybe we can learn from here in Colorado, advance further. I know a lot of community leaders in Colorado are probably doing that too. And I've seen great work by community members in Colorado alone at the local and state level too. Yeah. And so I would say that look there. I mean, even in city of Denver alone, there are some incredible community leaders and partnerships and work that's happening that I would say could be supported beyond that at different in different capacities and ways, whether it's from the Bison Conservation Program that city of Denver has to the Living Land Project that's happening in City Park here. And that's just a few miles away from me right now. Well, not even a mile. And all of this work to really highlight just tribal and indigenous communities and celebrate our communities. And I would also look to Minnesota. I've seen a lot of great things happening there and the work that the state is doing with various tribal nations there and the greater indigenous community in Minneapolis. And I would say that that's a great place to look at some of these different ideas too. I remember seeing this wonderful by a Dakota artist had made sort of this wraparound on one of the buses there and for their bus transit system where they were doing a celebration and saying, this is, you know, Dakota land and other things like that. And wouldn't that be really special to see that here in Colorado too? And also places like California that work with over 120 different tribal nations within their state boundaries is just remarkable to learn from other, you know, public servants that are working out there as they're working on California state parks and different things that can be done here in Colorado too. And I also, you know, like to think about the work that's happening up in Canada too with the First Nations there that have led in a lot of ways. And when I think about their indigenous protected and conserved areas, that's really focused and on true co-management in a lot of ways, that would be wonderful to really be able to see here in Colorado too. So I think there are just these incredible, you know, actions and creative approaches that are sort of breaking through these stuffy systems, these bureaucratic systems, to bring more to indigenize them, to really bring an indigenous perspective into these spaces in an important, meaningful way that doesn't account from it from just a situation where you're saying, sure, we're giving you a seat at the table, but only if you assimilate to our process. I think that's not a good way to approach this, and that too many times that has been the way that the government has approached this more recently to kind of give themselves a pat on the back. And that really this is about how can you really bring, you know, sovereign entities, tribal nations into this space that is respectful, is meaningful, is sovereignty affirming, and that's also doing that in a way that is, you know, self-determination affirming for Indigenous communities.
So do you get the opportunity to directly interact with, you know, similar types of roles to yours in other states or, you know, Canada, wherever, here locally? I mean, is there like a, I don't know, conference or something for people in roles like yours?
Well, I would say there are a number of different conferences where you will get a lot of maybe state tribal liaisons going to, depending on the particular subject matter, and, you know, whether it's like land trust or conservation conferences, things like that.
we don't have one in Colorado that necessarily really, I would say, is a true, you know, hit on that. But I would love to see one. Wouldn't that be great to see one here that's bringing us all together and, you know, in a way that's really meaningful and focused on Colorado issues and sharing that knowledge and information that we're learning and having that be reciprocated with other, you know, state tribal liaison representatives and others working in this space. So we do have a good amount of collaborative work that's happening between, you know, state tribal liaisons, both, you know, across the United States. I call people up a lot to be able to talk with them, learn from them, and really be able to get their perspectives. There isn't a formal sort of state tribal liaison conference or gathering, but you do see a lot of state or, you know, tribal liaisons at the state level, federal level, and beyond at specific types of conferences that may be within their area of work. And that's a good way for us to connect too. I think it would be wonderful to be able to see that type of conference specifically maybe happen here in Colorado and to have a larger tribal summit that brings in other tribal liaisons and tribal nations and community members that work in these areas to Colorado as well. And that it's specific in that way to encompass all natural and cultural resource issues. So maybe that'll happen in the future here. Maybe it'll happen in the next 5 years. Who knows?
All right. Well, on that note, unfortunately, I think that is all that I can ask you today, but I will harass you personally in a couple weeks and we can talk more about all kinds of things. But thank you so much again for taking the time to come on. I know how busy your schedule is. And so I'm very grateful that you were able to make time to come on the podcast, and just appreciate you and all the work that you do.
Oh, absolutely, Jessica. Thank you for inviting me. And gosh, I hope that at least something in here in today's conversation is helpful to others or might be of interest. And I really look forward to continuing to be an avid listener of your podcast.
Yes. And hi to the puppy that I can hear in the background.
Sorry about that.
It was so cute just hear him shaking. But all right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.